Good afternoon. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Tuesday, March the 2nd, 2022. And there is a ton of interesting stuff going on in the world today. I just had to leave listening to the interesting Senate confirmation hearings of the probable new Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court to join my guest today, Stefan Tajik, who is a consultant, and from what I've read, a serious one and a good one with a lot of interesting ideas in the investment migration industry. Now, what investment migration is I think a catch-all term that would govern citizenship by investment. You know, you can buy a second citizenship these days, residency by investment, and general focus on giving people options for where else they might want to live their lives. And all of this is taking place, of course, in the context of lots of stuff going on in the world, most notably the attack on Ukraine, which is having a spillover effect on all aspects of society. And I'm looking forward to hearing some of Stefan's thoughts on how that particular episode is affecting the investment migration industry. So let's get started. Well, Stefan, thanks so much for joining me. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you, John. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, you've been in this space, this investment migration space, for quite a while, I think, haven't you?
It's been over a decade.
That would make you although you look to me like a fairly young guy, that would make you a senior citizen, I think, in the world of investment migration. In other words, you got involved in this, I think, long before a lot of the people who populate this space did. Is that correct?
Yeah, you can say before the big bang of investment migration.
Before the big bang. Okay, that's a good way to put it. So what got you into this? I mean, why would somebody be interested in investment migration? You're living in Montreal, Canada, which, you know, seems to me to be a very civilized place. I like it very much. And, you know, Canada has many faults, but I think it's fairly civilized. So what's got you thinking and focusing on global mobility and that? How'd you get started in this?
Around 12 years ago, I myself was mostly an entrepreneur, young entrepreneur starting businesses and being involved with the family business and everything. And I was approached by one of my friends who was dealing with immigrant investors at the time. And at the time, we're talking about 15 years ago, the Canadian program for immigrant investor was the main program.
In the world, wasn't it?
Yeah. Hong Kong had a very strong program, which doesn't exist nowadays, but Montreal had the biggest program historically. And he was asking me about ways that we can help investors settle in the country more efficiently. So help them integrate economically in the economy. That got me interested a lot because you meet very interesting people, a lot of them with, you know, a lot of qualities, but don't have the know-how to be efficient in running a business in Canada. So I met a lot of investors and I realized this was a gap between what's expected from the investor on the government side after the land and the reality. So I pitched the program to the government, a post-landing program, an economic integration program to the government right back then. And that got me to know a lot of people, the ministers, et cetera, et cetera. Unfortunately, a lot of changes in government at the time. Quebec's not the most stable province in Canada in terms of governance, made it practically impossible to get anything going at the time. And then the Canadian program, the Canadian investor program, was suspended and then shut down by the federal government, which left the Quebec program the only one open in the country.
Okay. For the benefit of listeners on this, I mean, so I think that Canada basically was ground zero in investment migration, wasn't it?
You know, you can see that, yes.
Way, way before the rest of the world. Could you, describe how the Canadian program worked and what the intent of it was, and then why you think it was shut down?
Now, the program changed a lot through the years. It started in the mid-80s, okay? The latest version was basically investing in government bonds or something similar to a government bond, okay? You place your money for the last amount for the federal was $800,000. You place it for 5 years, you get no return on investment, but instead you get a permanent residence.
Okay. So really this was, and you know, there's nothing at all wrong with this, okay, at all. What this was an attempt by the government of Canada to essentially, you know, attract relatively wealthy entrepreneurs to Canada.
Yeah, it was a way for the government to attract capital, cheap capital for them, without paying any interest to the investors. And in exchange, give permanent residency to the investor and his family. Now, when the program was shut down, it was because, you know, 20, 30 years ago, interest rates were high. So when you were putting a bond in the market that was yielding 7% and you weren't paying any of those 7% because the investor was, you know, receiving 0% in the case of the investor program, it was very attractive. But as interest rates start going lower and lower after the financial crisis in 08, 09, the program start yielding less and less returns. So the government, instead of finding a solution for that, just realized he wasn't capable of and just shut down the program.
That's interesting. And as far as I know, there's no particular evidence that that will be resurrected. At least I haven't seen anything, but I think you're more attuned to this than I am.
Nothing on the federal side, no.
Nothing.
I don't think it's a priority or has been a priority the past 10 years practically.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. But of course, you know, the Canadian program did set an example. Maybe not in all respects, but certainly the world was watching. Mm-hmm. And a number of other countries put together similar programs. So where do we then go in the history of this? So we start with Canada, and what were sort of the next ones, sir?
So what was interesting is that Canada had maybe an application size, a demand size of thousands each year. So thousands and thousands would apply to the program each year. So when that shut down, there was thousands and thousands of applicants that needed to be rerouted to other programs. And then some of them were rerouted to the Quebec program, which caused a massive backlog and drove processing time very high. And the rest was mainly redirected to the US. If you see the US EB-5 program, how it grew in the past decade, you will see the exact correlation of when the program in Canada shut down, and then when it was how the EB-5 started picking up number of application until it reached its cap.
Very, 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 very interesting. Now, the Canadian program was actually far less expensive from a buyer's perspective, wasn't it, than the EB-5?
Not necessarily. It depends at the time, because as you know, interest rate went lower, the program went from $250,000 investment to $400,000 to $800,000, and the Quebec program to $1.2 million in the space of practically a decade or so due to interest rate.
All right, so basically, from the perspective of the governments, these are really just ways to attract capital and return for permanent residence. And the US calls that's called the green card. Canada's called permanent resident. And from the perspective of the buyer, though, what is it that they see themselves as getting? You know, what's the attraction here?
Well, obviously, it's not the investment, because in the case of Canuck investment, government bonds at 0% interest is not the most attractive type of investment, but is obtaining permanent residency in Canada in that case.
Okay. You know, now that makes sense, assuming that people want permanent residency in Canada or, you know, want permanent residency in the U.S., but what would be the kind of person? I mean, like, who's that aimed at? Why does, you know, in your experience, you know, you talk to people, like, why in the early days? Like, now it's the rage. You know, everybody talks about Plan B, second citizenship, you know, like, these are just things everybody should have as sort of an accessory. But in the early years, that wasn't the way it was working at all. In fact, people would have to have, I think, a clear motivation, incentive to go to the trouble to do this. Now, in the case of Canada, I'm presuming that a lot of this would have been linked to the handover of Hong Kong to China.
That's correct. And that's basically what started this whole industry, is that massive shift that happened of so many Hong Kongers looking to relocate somewhere else.
Or if not to relocate, at least have the right to relocate, I suppose.
Yes. And a lot of them were, you know, there was that fear where they needed either to relocate or have the ability to relocate fast. Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of them chose. That's how the program in Canada actually started, with the entrepreneur program back in the late 70s. And was an investor program was added later on, but it was mainly to capture and cater to those Hong Kong high net worth individual.
Okay. Now, I don't have a lot of personal knowledge of this, but I've heard anecdotally and read all over the place that many of these people who got permanent residence in Canada, from their point of view, it was really an option. They didn't move to Canada, or they perhaps they spent enough time to satisfy some kind of a physical presence test to keep the permanent residence card. But I mean, is that your sense of it, that it truly was, you know, just buying the insurance of being able to get somewhere else quickly?
I think in this case, there was all type of people. There were some people that actually completely relocate. Some of them partially relocate or relocated a certain amount of time in Canada, then went back, or the opposite, you know, continued and retired in Canada. And some of them never really showed up. Obviously, there was laws that was required to uphold to maintain your status, and then to apply for citizenship that requires a lot of physical presence. Now, how closely were those monitored back then by the authorities? It's something that's really unclear.
I don't think it was particularly monitored in the early years. I mean, my impression is it wasn't until the Harper government really where, you know, the issues of citizenship and immigration sort of took center stage. But in any case, it's not that easy to get into Canada anymore. I mean, it doesn't have a retirement visa. I mean, it can be done. I mean, there's all kinds of programs, but it's not like this, you know, off the shelf, easy thing to navigate anymore, I suppose, is it?
Not at all. Yeah, absolutely. There's no investor program. Like you said, there's no retiree program. So if you're coming to Canada now, you need to have a specific activity. The only thing I would say that is the closest to would be, for example, in Ontario, they have an express entry program called the Human Capital Priority Stream.
Can you describe that briefly?
Yeah, so it's basically like a global talent visa. So you need to have a strong background, professional background, usually in categories of employment that are in demand. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that makes it maybe unique is the fact that you don't need an employment contract.
I'm sorry, you do or you do not?
You do not.
You do not necessarily need a contract. That's interesting.
You have enough points just to show up and say, well, this is who I am. I have a very strong background, especially for Americans that speak English and, you know, are very well integrated. They can just show up and get PR.
Well, I noticed, yeah, I mean, just sort of, you know, perusing this briefly yesterday, I saw that it was interesting to me. I think it's nursing one of the professions where
Yeah, that's a possibility. So Ontario, every few months, update the classification of the employment categories. Mm-hmm. It's mostly geared toward tech and engineering, but you will see all sorts of sometime employment categories.
What about this postgraduate work permit? You know, it seems to me to be an invitation for somebody to get a university degree in Canada, stay on and get permanent residence, et cetera. I mean, that's still alive and well, is it?
Yes. It's made a bit more difficult perhaps in the province of Quebec, but right now everything's more complicated for immigration purposes in the province of Quebec.
I mean, you know, that strikes me as a very, very simple, you know, easily accessible mechanism. I mean, if you're willing to think, you know, 3 to 5 years down the road, do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got the Canada, the US thing. I noticed the EB-5 thing has been, I don't know if it was completely dead, but I'll use the word resurrected recently.
Yeah.
You know, I think that people ought to be very wary of that because of the US tax issues, but in any case. So what are some of the other countries that sort of, you know, got on the ship, so to speak, and started creating these? I mean, you know, you go to these conferences, like, you know, the Investment Migration Conference, or Henley, you know, these sorts of things. I mean, they're just, you know, constantly talking about these things. So how do you see the world, or at least as it was 4 months ago? Okay, we'll get to where it is now, but as it was up to four months ago, how do you see the world of investment migration?
Well, the world of investment migration always have, you know, when there's instability in the world, when there's movement, or any actually situation is good for business if you want, right? It's always a question though, if, you know, sometimes you have a problem of demand, sometimes you have a problem of supply. So the last few years had been very good. The industry was growing. Even the US, even Americans were now becoming part of the demand.
We'll get to that in a minute. You know, you had some interesting comments on that. And as somebody who, you know, essentially works to expatriate Americans, they have to have somewhere. I thought your comments were interesting. We'll get to that in a minute. Leaving aside the US thing, I mean, you know, geographically, let's start off with citizenship by investment versus residence by investment. And so the difference would be the one you get citizenship, the other you get permanent residence that may lead to citizenship down the road, but that's not the primary product you're buying, right?
In certain cases, you even get just simply temporary residency. But in reality, the perception is between the two is how fast you get citizenship. Because even certain citizenship program, for example, the one in Malta, requires you to spend to hold a resident permit for a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. And certain resident permit can access citizenship pretty fast. So we'd say, you know, it's all about how fast you can obtain citizenship, whereas residency is simply residency.
Okay. Is that how people see it? Or, you know, do you find that, you know, your whole client base, these masses out there, do they make a meaningful distinction between citizenship and residence?
You have to explain to them time to time, because not all of them are literate on, you know, what's temporary residency, what's permanent residency, what's naturalization, et cetera, et cetera. So for somebody, a lot of people confused citizenship by investment and residency by investment, that's for sure. Some people might think, oh, the citizenship, Portugal has a citizenship by investment program, or Canada has a citizenship by investment program, which is not accurate.
Yeah, no, it does not. Okay. So let's say we were to divide the world into sort of geographical portals, if you will, for this. Why don't we start with the Caribbean things, which are, I think, by far the best marketed, you know, at least, you know, from my vantage point. So maybe you can identify some of the programs and give me your thoughts first on the geography of that, and then secondly, the programs themselves. So we're Caribbean, we're talking What countries, what programs?
Well, you have the Caribbean Five, Antigua, Barbuda, Dominica, Grenada, St. Lucia, and St. Kitts and Nevis. St. Kitts was the first one to create a program back in 84. I think Dominica joined after that in 93, and the rest pretty much came up after that. We had other countries that were here and there. Belize had a program back then as well. There was a program even in the Pacific Oceans very early on. But the Caribbean are pretty much the standard one, if you want.
Okay, and I think my impression is the least expensive. I mean, you can get those for in the $100,000 range. Am I right on that?
Exactly. It's the standard season by investment program.
So you give them money, you give them $100,000, they give you citizenship. I mean, that's basically what the transaction looks like. Although
exactly,
and as real estate or
exactly, and the main attribute of those passports is you gain visa-free access to the Schengen area.
All of them?
All of them.
That's not bad, actually. That's not bad. With the Grenada, you're eligible for what, an E-1 visa or something with the United States, is that correct?
Yeah, you have E-1, E-2.
E-1, E-2. Okay, in other words,
it's their value because it's a 5 years, it's a 5 year visa. All of them also, except all of them now actually gives you visa for travel to Russia. And Grenada and Dominica now also to China. So if you compare to a U.S. passport, for somebody, I like to say is, you know, a lot of business people, sales rep have to travel to BRIC countries. And sometimes the U.S. passport is not the most efficient for BRIC countries to travel to. You pick up something like a Dominica or Grenada that can facilitate a lot your travels in those countries.
Well, that's interesting. And, you know, that's certainly a factor. But do you find that's a huge factor in terms of people buying second citizenships, the, you know, the value of the passport as a travel document, or do you think it's more other things?
I think it's probably 70-80% of the reason.
The visa?
At least depending on the markets. But for somebody from China, somebody from India, somebody from a country whose passport is weak, that would be the main reason to get a second
passport. Okay, very, very interesting. And you know, the weaker passports in the world, just to give this some context, would be what?
I'm pretty sure it's Afghanistan right now.
Afghanistan, okay. Yeah. Who could have known? All right. Okay.
But a lot of them are obviously Middle Eastern countries, African countries. And at the end of the day, it's not necessarily, you know, where you can go, it's where you can't go. And the most attractive or the places that everybody wants to go, and we can know that very easily by the number of touristic arrivals per country, are mainly in Europe. Talking about France, Spain, Italy, the UK, which is not in the EU anymore, but still. You have China, the US, you have Brazil, India, who are in the top 10 also. So these are the main destination, but it remains the EU is by far the most attractive destination to visit.
Okay, and to be clear again, so these Caribbean passports give you visa-free access to that group of countries, correct?
Exactly.
Oh, that's good. All right, so we've got the Caribbean ones, which seem to be the most visible. But the second category, I mean, there are certain European, I think, citizenship by investment programs, but you have to, I think, dig deeper, and they're more costly, right? But what would be some examples of those?
Well, today there's only one example. It's Malta, which would set you back, you can say $1 million cash.
Oh, that's quite a difference. Okay. So, I mean, my God, you could buy all five in the Caribbean for that, couldn't you?
Yeah, you definitely could. But the reason why it's priced that way, first of all, is scarcity. It's the only one that will give you visa-free access to the US. Mm-hmm. And two, it's the only one remaining as well that will give you freedom of movement in the European Economic Area.
So if the US were to shut down the visa-free access, that would severely diminish the value of that passport, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
So, you know, that's an interesting point, right? That, you know, a lot of the things that can affect the value of these things are completely out of your control. All right. So those are the citizenship. Now, one of the things that, you know, that I know and you know, but I don't think it's an awful lot of publicity, is that a lot of people can get second citizenships without buying them at all. They're just entitled to them through ancestry, right?
Correct. Correct. Obviously that, you know, if we're talking about EU citizenship, for somebody in India or China, that might not work, might be very limited. But for Americans, that's the beauty of it for them, is that, you know, we did a little analysis on the subject, and potentially you have 40% of Americans that could qualify for a sort of citizenship by ancestry.
That's incredible. Can you give me an example of how that might work for somebody?
So we already have, let's say, Italians' ancestry. There's roughly 20 to 30 million Americans with Italian ancestry. So, you know, without going too much deep into how you can be eligible to it, it's run by right of blood. So even if your parents weren't really Italian citizens or never claimed it, it suffices that you have somebody who had it and the blood connection wasn't lost at the right timing for you to be able to claim it.
So really, I just think grandparent or something like that.
It can be grandparents. It can very well be great, great, great grandparents.
That's incredible. Incredible. So, I mean, I hear a lot of that with people of Italian descent, Irish descent, Polish descent.
Polish descent as well, Hungarian, Czech, Slovak, Lithuanian. So there's a whole lot.
Oh, my God.
That can go really something. Yeah. And surprisingly as well, some people don't expect it, is Latino Americans. Because it's not a direct route, but if you are, for example, a Mexican national, you can claim Spanish citizenship after 2 years of residence, contrary to 10 years for other type of foreigners.
So you get Mexican citizenship and then get Spanish citizenship.
Yeah. But I mean, a lot of Americans are Mexican citizenship or Mexican descent.
Sure.
Even people in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, the same thing. Isn't that if you're a citizen of Puerto Rico, you can get Spanish citizenship as well? Yeah.
That's correct. Actually, in the case of Puerto Rico, a simple permanent residency for Puerto Rico would suffice, which somebody can get after a year.
That's interesting. So there are a lot of possibilities that don't necessarily involve, you know, paying these huge amounts of money, which is quite interesting. All right. So we compare that then to the residence by investment programs. And these, I guess, you know, when I hear the words golden visa, you know, I associate that. Is that Portugal? But I mean, I don't make huge distinctions on these. I mean, they all seem to me to operate on basically the same principle, don't they?
Well, traditional investor visa was pretty much every country in the world could have adopted one. Mm-hmm. Because in essence, is if someone, a foreigner, come and invest in your country, you want to give them a stable status for them to access that investment. You don't want to put them in a situation where they need to file something, go to court in regard to that investment, and they cannot gain entry to the country. Yeah. So at base, that's what it was. Now, what country has started doing and saying, well, we want to attract certain type of investment that we believe would be good for our country. So we're going to structure a program where we're going to say, if you make this type of investment, we're going to give you residency rights. And then they're starting putting in more incentives to be more attractive to foreign investors.
These would be like tax incentives, right?
tax incentives. It can be flexible residency option, saying, you know, you just need to spend a few days a year or at least come once a year to maintain your status and things like that.
All right. So that's an interesting overview of where it's been. But, you know, what is it, 3 weeks ago, I think the world changed a great deal in terms of discussion about citizenship by investment with this whole Russia thing. Now, just to kind of get to the bottom line and work our way backwards, all right, you and I both were listening to the same discussion this morning, and certainly I've been reading about this everywhere, that, you know, the citizenship by investment industry is really, really under attack now by the politicians, right?
Yes, it started, I would say, in 2019, the first EU Parliament report on the subject, which was basically calling for the closure of these programs.
All of them, everywhere, or just?
Citizenship, there was probably no doubt about that, at least in the European Union. It was really focused on the European Union. The idea that Europe would force the hand of the Caribbean only appeared in the last maybe month or so.
So presumably that would be just denying the visa-free access, right?
In the case of the Caribbean?
Yeah.
Yes, it could be as simple as that. And I've done it with Vanuatu, which was a huge shock.
Yeah, so, you know, once again, it's so interesting that, you know, it's one thing to say, well, what's the state of this today? But, you know, when the viability of this stuff is under the control of a third-party government, you know, that is dangerous. So I see also that there's a lot of, you know, we're going to sanction Russia by punishing individual Russians. We're not going to let those individual Russians have access to these citizenship by investment programs. Is that sort of an accurate synopsis of it?
Yes, yes. And even beyond that, they're using a bit kind of the scarecrow as a scarecrow, the Russian oligarch, to block and close all the residency programs. And that was something that was clearly visible in 2019 with the first report, even though they didn't state it precisely, but behind investor was the word Russia.
You know, it's exactly the same as, you know, the U.S. justifies, some politicians in the U.S. justify citizenship taxation on the basis that, you know, U.S. oligarchs might escape U.S. tax. And this sounds like, you know, the same type of thing, justifying a ban on Russians, saying, well, because there might be a Russian oligarch or something, right?
Exactly. And great. The strange thing is it applies only to investment migration program, but doesn't apply to other immigration paths.
Okay, so in other words, it ends one part of the discussion, but really opens up a more serious consideration of perhaps the other avenues, right?
Yes.
I mean, we don't have anything yet that says, you know, no Russian national is acceptable anywhere in the world, right?
No, but I feel that there might be some sort of indirect sanctions, if you want. Give you for an example, because they need to provide to do due diligence on each case or each person that applied to a certain extent. They might start spending much more time processing your case. For example, in Canada, if you have, let's say, Iranian, the case is an Iranian applicant, it's going to take more time. And maybe through the process, the person's not going to continue. But it's kind of those barriers that can be put in place.
Yeah, so more administrative stuff. So there are a number of participants in the industry who I think rightfully so are, you know, generally quite concerned with the reputation and promotion of the industry itself, which I think, well, at least I'm a member of the Investment Migration Council. I suspect you may be as well. This is the organization that comes to mind in terms of generally, you know, trying to project a positive image for the industry. I mean, the IMC has come out with a, an informal licensing program, I think, or some kind of competency certificate on this. And I know that for years that, you know, they've been very, very concerned with the overall reputation of these programs. I mean, just sort of, as a participant on the ground, I mean, do you think that the, you know, this allegation that, you know, these programs are helping people launder money or this, do you think this stuff is generally accurate?
There's two aspects, is whether it's the case or not, that we need to prove that. There need to be concrete proof that some people that have went through those programs have done those things. And then we have to see if, you know, if it's 5%, 50%, 100%, or 0.0001%, right? Which this has not been done by the EU Parliament. So they're making statement very
basically. They're just making it up, basically.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
There's a few cases, yes, but there's not a EU report wide on this. And the second thing is, the second aspect is that whatever you can do on a golden visa, you can do on any type of visa. You can do on a retirement visa, you can do on a work visa, you can do on a student visa. I can go in Europe on any visas and still buy a house, register, get a tax number, buy a property, open a bank account, transfer money, do all sorts of illicit activities on any sort of visa. The difference is I don't have to spend the $500,000 in investment for it and have
extremely
good diligence.
Yeah, and this is a point that you make in your article, your recent article. I would recommend all your articles, right, in the imidaily.com, I think. But, you know, you make this point in the recent article, why would anybody spend that kind of money, you know, when they can do this, you know, if they're really doing something bad, well, they can do the same bad thing under the radar less expensively, right?
Correct.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right, so would it be a fair statement that these programs right now are under extreme pressure? They're under duress?
Yes, there was already the past, like we said, the past few years, there was forces in the EU that were fighting against it. This being intensified with the Russian war.
In other words, it's just given the excuse.
It's given an excuse, and then there's no voices for arguing anymore.
Nobody's listening. You know, we've had this horrific event take place, and, you know, it's because of the Russian government. Therefore, clearly all these Russians, you know, oligarchs, what have you ever met a Russian oligarch?
No, I haven't.
I haven't either. I've also never met a U.S. billionaire tax cheat. Have you?
No. I haven't met many billionaires, I can tell you that. But obviously, you know, us growing up in, living in North America, we all has this image of the Russian who was provided to us by the media, who was Russians are scary. A lot of them are criminals, you know, some of them might have killed people, you know. This is kind of the media image we have. So overall, when we see a Russian on the street, we might be scared of them. But, out of all the Russians I've met, obviously none of them are like
that.
Can
you tell what they look like? Can you identify a Russian walking down the street? They're all over Toronto, you know, apparently. I mean, there's this, but anyway, yeah. So what, you know, now, your article, which again was, I think, a very good article. I mean, you either said or strongly implied that you think that the formal buying citizenship programs, the formal mm-hmm. citizenship by investment programs are sort of effectively over or will be over soon. I mean, is that really what you think, or do you think this whole thing will be worked out?
I hope this thing can be worked out, at least for the sake of the Caribbean countries who are very dependent on those programs, especially when taking consideration that the natural disasters that can affect these small islands have huge financial consequences. And in the past few years, their ability to go find funding from those Sejima investment programs have helped them tremendously and rebuild and come out of, you know, severe poverty. A lot of these Caribbean nations, you know, taking the example of St. Kitts, were very, very poor after the collapse of the sugar industry. So they have to fight tooth and nail to be able to retain something.
Yeah. I think that I like your analysis. I mean, I tend to agree. There's no way to stop migration, okay? I mean, it's just part of human history. You know, people being able to go and wanting to go different places. And I think that the way it looks may be different, the way they achieve it may be different, and obviously evolving. But, you know, the reality is that the demand will continue. I mean, there's certainly just as many people trying to get in Canada as there were, you know, when this, you know, before this program was shut down.
Increase, I think, over time, we're going to see more mobility. When more mobility.
Do you think it's the COVID thing has given people a stronger consciousness of, you know, boy, I better have another place to go?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The idea that you couldn't travel for a certain amount of time created a little travel revenge thing.
Oh, I think that's right. But I think for many people, it was really their first experience in life of, you know, the equivalent of a wall being put up, right?
Yeah. Very feeling like a third world country citizen.
Well, I don't know about a third world, but
in terms of mobility, travel mobility.
A different perspective. I mean, I think in North America, we've taught to think of walls as keeping people out. And I think that, mm-hmm. you know, perhaps part of the COVID thing was the analogy of the wall keeping people in, right? Yeah. Which was an interesting thing, which really brings us to the whole U.S. consciousness on the market there. But, you know, what I'd like to do with you, this has been a great discussion, is let's stop this podcast and pick up with a second one on the U.S. situation. Are you up for that?
Sounds good.
All right. This is great. And I'm speaking with Stefan Tajik, who is, I would call him a citizenship by investment or human mobility consultant or researcher or something. Where would people get a hold of you? Where are your coordinates?
You can reach me while globalrcg.com. You'll have our website and you can find me on their team, and you probably have a nice little bio over there.
All right. Well, that's great. Well, we'll pick this up in just a second, talking about the U.S. market.